Hello and good evening, good morning. You are listening to The Other Side of Midnight. I'm filling in for your regular host, Richard C. Hoagland, and I'm Dr. Robin Falkov, and let's see who wins, me or the music. It's great to be on with you, and gosh, what an evening we have in store for you all. And John Perkins, our guest tonight, happens to be one of my favorite people. I mean, his work has been such a change for so many to wake things up for them. And I've got to get all these sounds around us turned off. I think we've got everybody set. Okay. And everything is good here. And I'm just getting all the other noises turned off. And there we go. So hang in there with me, guys. I've got a whole bunch of other things open, and I want to give you some background. I happen to have three of John's books here with me, and he has many, and I'd like you to know they're available in audiobooks because I gave them to my family the Christmas before last because I know how they are about reading, and I wanted to make sure that they would have access to this important information. So the ones I have, of course, are Confessions of an Economic Hitman, The Secret History of the American Empire, Hoodwink, and the new book. Well, I'll tell you about that right now as we get into some of John's background. So we look at what his research has shown and the question about who are today's economic hitmen. And this is what brought about the need for a new edition. And let me tell you guys that there are 15 explosive new chapters. And I'm waiting to see them because when you understand the game plan and then you look at events from 2004 to now, I mean, you can see that handwriting coming through loud and clear. And after tonight, you guys are going to have the same ability to put all those pieces of the puzzle together. So this first book was a New York Times million copy bestseller about economic hitmen. And it gives the tools for us to fight back to a lot of the craziness going on all around the world. And John Perkins was a former economic hitman. He's walked in both worlds, and we're fortunate that he decided to step into ours and stay here and be able to share this information. And in his books, he shared new details and old details in the old ones about the way he and others cheated countries around the globe out of trillions of dollars. And there's a formula here, guys, that you recognize. And he reveals just how deadly the electronic economic hitman cancer has spread far more widely and deeply than ever in the United States and everywhere else to become the dominant system of business, government, and society today. So you will get that insider view, and many of you who are familiar with what's going on now with the trade treaty nightmares, understand about the corporatocracy. You understand about the power that that has and the way it infiltrates all aspects of our lives. And the passage of these trade treaties will more or less cement that elevation of the corporatocracy to be able to have their final steps for achieving this control that is so insidious, it's in all aspects of our lives. So we find that John Perkins was the front man for this system that traded in fraud, rigged elections, payoffs, extortion, sex, and even murder. And in his book, you find so much that lays out what has happened throughout Asia, Africa, Latin America, and the Middle East, and I'm hoping John will go into the story about Panama, which is one of my favorite stories, because there are a lot of people that were running the governments there, and as much as they were leaned on, they did have their allegiance first to the people of their country. It wasn't many, and many couldn't withstand the pressure that was brought to bear about on them, But these are just stories that are chilling when you see what goes on behind the scenes. And the electronic hitmen were sort of the first line that went in. And then you had the jackal assassins and the military, and we'll let John expand upon all of that and connect those dots for you. So I'm very pleased to be on with John Perkins tonight, for you to have your eyes opened, your horizons broadened, and understand what we need to do to put a stop to all this insanity. Welcome, John. What a pleasure to have you with us.
Thank you, Robin. It's great to be here. I had to get you off mute. We're having our electrical difficulties today, aren't we? So anyway, it's wonderful to be with you tonight. Thanks.
Thank you. Yes. Fortunately, things are going well. There have been a lot of outages across the country from Comcast, and they've been checking with us to make sure our connections are good because of those problems. But things have been stable. They were stable for me earlier today for my own show. So I'm encouraged. We should be having smooth sailing. So your story is so compelling. And I know one of the leaders out there was my colleague, Ed Griffin, to talk about your work and get it out there. And I wish I had, you know, looked into your information when I first learned about it. But as soon as I did, of course, it's so compelling. You have to get more of the books. You have to read more. Your videos are present online. And it just is a story that people think can't be real. So how did you get to the point where you decided to step out of that world and into this one?
Well, I was in that world for about 10 years, and incidentally, my official title was chief economist at Charles T. Maine, which was a major consulting firm at the time and has since been bought up by another company, so it's been absorbed. The name no longer exists, but it had been a major consulting firm out of Boston for about 100 years. We were a very low-profile firm, but extremely influential around the world. And I got out of business school, and in business school, we're taught that the things I did as an economic hitman were the right things to do to help poor countries get wealthier. But I very quickly began to see that the opposite was happening, that the statistics showed that the economy was increasing, but in fact, those statistics only reflected the very wealthy families in those countries, as is increasingly the case in the United States. You know, here we can have economic growth looking very good, while at the same time, unemployment is increasing, and so are foreclosures on homes. And that reflects the fact that a few rich people, relatively few rich people and their families, really skew the statistics very much in their favor. So when the rich get richer, it looks like everything's getting better, when in fact, often things are getting worse. And it took me a while to see that. But as I did see it, I actually found myself rather stuck in the system for a while. Finally, after about 10 years, I had an incredibly moment of enlightenment. One of these, you know, times that you hear about people having, but I actually experienced one after I'd been in the job for about 10 years. I was in the Virgin Islands. I can go into more detail if you like, but and that really convinced me that it was time to get out.
Sure, sure. I think it's helpful because people have to realize exactly how mainstream you were, consulting to the World Bank, the United Nations, the IMF, the U.S. Treasury Department. You know, it's not these are the power centers that people think of. So it had to be something really of impact that got you changing. What took place? Can you share that?
Yes, and it might be good to give a little background on what I actually did, more than even consulting to the World Bank and those organizations. I used them to essentially bribe and convince, seduce, con presidents of countries into accepting loans from those organizations. So really, my job as an economic hitman was to identify countries with resources that our corporations covet, like oil, then arrange a huge loan to that country from the World Bank or one of those types of organizations, one of its sisters. But the money would never actually go to the country. Instead, it would go to our own corporations like Bechtel, Halliburton, General Electric, Sonnen Webster, big companies to build infrastructure projects in that country. And of course, the main beneficiaries would be our own corporations. Secondary beneficiaries would be a few wealthy families in those companies, in those countries, excuse me, that own the industrial parks, the commercial centers that use the electricity that was built by these World Bank loans, or the highways, the ports, all these big infrastructure projects. However, the majority of the people would actually suffer because money that had been earmarked for education, healthcare, and other social services now would be diverted to try to pay off the interest on the loans. And in the end, the principal would never be repaid on the loans. And so we'd go back and say, hey, you know, since you can't pay your debts, sell your oil real cheap or whatever the resource was to our corporations and privatize. Sell your electric utilities, your water and sewage system, your schools, your jails, all your public service businesses to our corporations. And perhaps allow us to build a military base on your soil. In this way, we really created a new form of empire, an empire that was based less on military and more on debt, on economic enslavement. And it was really, it's a corporate empire more than an American empire. And I have to say, Robin, that in the few cases where economic hitmen fail, the jackals go in. These are people who either overthrow governments or assassinate their leaders. And I talk in the new Confessions of an Economic Hitman, my new book, about how I failed with the president of Ecuador and the head of state of Panama, Jaime Roldos and Omar Torrijos. And they did not buy into this game. They had tremendous integrity, and both of them were assassinated. And, oh, wait, I never did respond to your question about the moment of enlightenment. Do you want me to do that now, or shall we continue with this?
Well, we can continue and get back to that. And I found your story about Panama just so heartbreaking because, as you laid it out in the book, you knew what was coming, and so did he. But he had to stand by his principles. And I guess those were two rarities, those two men from Panama and Ecuador, the two leaders.
Yeah, you know, it took a tremendous amount of courage for both of them to do what they did.
Yeah.
Because they were very aware that other presidents or heads of state who had such integrity were gone. You know, the United States, we've admitted that the CIA had a coup that took out Arbenz of Guatemala and Allende of Chile, Lumumba of the Congo, Mossadegh of Iran, Diem of Vietnam, and many, many others. And so heads of state are very aware that they're extremely vulnerable. So both Roldos of Ecuador and Torrijos of Panama were aware that they were in extremely dangerous situations. Nonetheless, they had the integrity to move forward with their consciences and with what they had promised their people. It did put me in a very difficult position, especially Torrijos of Panama, because I'd become quite good friends with him. He was a very charismatic leader. Roldos was an amazing leader too, but not quite as open to friendship. He was a bit more introverted. But Torrijos of Panama, I became very close with him. I had a tremendous admiration for him, for both these men. And the fact that they would not accept the deals that I was offering was troublesome to me. First of all, it meant I wasn't doing my job. I wasn't succeeding at my job, which is always awkward. But second of all, I also realized that if they did not play the game, something dire was likely to happen to them. And I liked them both very much. At the same time, I had a tremendous respect for them for the fact they had such integrity. I was extremely shocked and saddened when they were assassinated. And at that point, I had gotten out of being an economic hitman and decided to start writing about it and exposing the system.
Yeah, I mean, talk about having something that's worth dying for. They both were examples of that. And you provide the tools with your books with what has been going on throughout the European Union, and I look at the handwriting, you know, when the IMF shows up with all these big loans of entrapment that the countries will never be able to pay off, and just as you were saying, those compromises would have to be made, and as you laid out with Indonesia, the horrific environmental problems and contamination, because that was the trade-off for the corporations. And this was their standard format, wasn't it?
Yes. It's a strategy. There's no question about it. I mean, the intent here was to use economics to basically enslave countries. And you know, it's interesting that you mentioned Europe and Greece, Ireland, and Iceland, which officially is part of the European economy, Spain, Portugal. These are all countries are all suffering from this sort of thing now. And I've been in contact with Yanis Varoufakis, who is the former minister of finance of Greece, very well known now. He's become a real leader in Europe. And you know, he wrote a really nice endorsement for this new Confessions of an Economic Hitman. He and I have become, I guess we'd call it friends, although we've never met face to face. We've had a lot of telephone conversations and been on shows together. And he wrote a lot to me, but one of the most important things, which is quoted in the preface or in the front page of the new Confessions, he wrote, "This book resonates with my experiences of the brutish methods and gross economic irrationality guiding powerful institutions in their bid to undermine democratic control over economic power." And I think right there that says a great deal. Brutish methods and gross economic irrationality guiding powerful institutions, that's basically the corporations who then run governments, in their bid to undermine democratic control over economic power. So Yanis, you know, experienced this very much firsthand, how these methods have been used to subjugate Greece, as well as many other countries, to these corporate powers.
Yeah, I had a Greek reporter for my earlier shows, and I got up close and personal about what had been going on there for the past, I guess, 4 years, because you didn't really hear much about it. And the people of Greece were pretty much bad-mouthed. Nobody understood how the country had been entrapped, and that the, you know, the loans that continued to be made to them should never been made because they didn't have the ability to repay. And yet what happens? The people get vilified. So was I naive, John, because I was hoping so strongly that the people of Greece would be the ones to stick it to the EU and say, we're getting out.
Well, they wanted to, and that's why they voted in they re-elected the government that had promised to do that. The reason Yanis dropped out of that government was because once the government was re-elected, it didn't do it. It didn't have the guts to stay with it. It was afraid that its banking system would go bankrupt and that there'd be total chaos and turmoil. Yanis thought that was a mistake. I think it's a mistake. Iceland had done something similar a number of years before, and I was very involved. I went to Iceland several times. I'm not sure whether you're aware or not, but I was awarded the Yoko Ono John Lennon Peace Prize, which was given to me by Yoko Ono, both me and Lady Gaga, in Reykjavik, Iceland. But I'd spent a lot of time in Iceland trying to convince the Icelandic people to vote against paying back their loans.
I didn't know that. Thank you. Gosh, thank you. It worked.
It did. They, you know, they had a referendum and over 90% of them voted not to pay back their loans. And as a result, the country came out of the recession much quicker than any other country in the European zone. And it was extremely successful. We've seen similar things happen in Ecuador, Argentina, Brazil, other countries that refused to pay loans that they felt they really didn't know, because their corrupt leaders in all those countries had been seduced by economic hitmen into taking these loans.
Yes, definitely. And when I've cited the example of Iceland, people often say, oh, but that country is so small. And is it a logical plan to then say we just have to do it on a bigger scale if that was a small country?
Well, it's significant because Iceland, before it got hit back about 7 years ago, Iceland was listed as the third wealthiest country in the world on a per capita basis by the World Bank. And then it took on these loans because Alcoa Aluminum and a couple of other small aluminum companies convinced it to destroy a huge section of its territory north of the Arctic Circle, very fragile environment, to build big dams and create a huge watershed up there to produce hydroelectric power. And aluminum companies depend on cheap hydroelectric power to produce aluminum. And they set up a contract that the Icelandic leaders, who some of them later were indicted for this, whereby the price of the electricity that Iceland sold to the aluminum companies was directly tied into the price of aluminum. And it was an extremely bad deal for Iceland because the price of aluminum went down and Iceland ended up selling electricity for less than it cost Iceland to produce it, massive amounts to it of electricity to these big aluminum companies. And they did very, very well. And incidentally, those aluminum companies had a similar deal for bauxite, their raw material, with Jamaica. And so they were shipping bauxite from Jamaica up to Iceland, where it was turned into aluminum. And in both cases, they had these deals that enabled them to continue to make big profits, even as the price of aluminum went down. But both Jamaica and Iceland were badly hit in that process. And, you know, when I learned that Iceland had this contract, I immediately warned them that they were going to be in trouble. And a film was made about this. I was interviewed in the film before they actually hit the trouble mark. And then very soon after the film was made, Iceland went into a terrible, terrible recession because of this. So it went from the third wealthiest country per capita in the world to into bankruptcy. And it was totally done because economic hitmen from the aluminum companies hit it so hard.
And would you say that this was a faster progression than what had happened in other countries, what they did to Iceland?
You know, it was very pronounced because, yes, it happened very, very quickly. And part of the significance of Iceland, even though it's a small country, is that it was a developed country and not a developing country or a third world country. It was an advanced country in so many ways, including per capita economically. It happened so fast. And yet it's symbolic of what's happened around the world, usually in the past, to the economically developing or the third world countries. But Iceland was a watershed moment where we saw what was beginning to happen to the developed countries. So the reason I wrote the New Confessions of an Economic Hitman a little more than 11 years after the original Confessions of an Economic Hitman came out is because this system has spread so vastly around the world. Back when I was an economic hitman, the countries we were hitting were what we call third world countries, economically developing countries. Since my last book came out, and really the marker date is 9/11. 9/11 was the moment when the world changed. And since then, economic hitmen have spread throughout the world. And we in the United States now have been and are being hit, as is Europe. You know, Iceland, Greece, Ireland, Portugal, Spain. And the United States is being hit. So that's one of the reasons. There were two reasons I decided to write this, the New Confessions of an Economic Hitman. One is because things have gotten so much worse. Economic hitmen and jackals have spread to the United States and beyond. The second reason is that besides that, people are waking up around the world. I travel around the world constantly since that book came out, speaking in places like China and then all over the Middle East, all over Latin America, all over Europe and the United States. And everywhere I go, I find that people are understanding how nefarious, how bad the system has become. They're waking up to it. And so things are getting worse, and people are also waking up. It's almost like two tidal waves coming together, a consciousness revolution on the one hand, and a determination by the status quo, what I call the corporatocracy, to set up and keep power. And these two are clashing now. It's an amazingly important, pivotal time in world history. And that's really why I wrote this second book.
Yes. I can't wait to read it because what you're outlining in light of the awareness that has come from people with the trade treaties that are being pushed forward, and suddenly they're recognizing 250,000 people show up and protest in the streets in Germany, 70,000 in Poland. People don't want this around the world. And yet you have a president of this country telling the people, oh, don't worry about it. It's wonderful. You know, you just have to push it through. So it's not adding up and people are questioning. We'll be going to break in just a couple of minutes. So I was wanting to find out about the movie you mentioned. When you were in Iceland, you said that there was a movie that was made.
Right. Yes, it's called Dreamland. It's based on a book by a very well-known Icelandic writer, Andre Magnusson, who's become a good friend. And he wrote this book about the aluminum fiasco, this project that was built. He saw what was coming first. Then a very wealthy Icelandic businessman put several million dollars into making it. It's actually a beautiful film. And they came to me in the United States and interviewed me. And this is before the Icelandic economy collapsed for the film. And I sat there and said, hey, you know, I predict that your economy is going to collapse in the next couple of years. And it did. And so when the film was debuted, its premiere in Reykjavik, I was invited to go there. And I actually sat with the president of the country and watched the premiere of the movie. It was quite an experience.
Gosh, yes. I could imagine when you tell them what's coming and it happens. Is this now a picture that we could find released that we have access to viewing?
Yeah, I think you can get it on Netflix or Amazon.com. I'm not sure. It's called Dreamland or Dreamlandia. I'm not sure which name it's under right now, but it's a beautiful film, actually, and very, very telling.
Okay, well, I will certainly look for that, and I'm sure others will as well. So we will go to break. You've got a few minutes, and we will be back for more with John Perkins, Confessions of an Economic Hitman, and all that has been added to bring us up to date with the crazy events in the world today. Stay with us. We'll be right back. Okay, my friends, and we are back. I thank you for listening. This is The Other Side of Midnight. I'm your guest host tonight, Dr. Robin Falcoff, filling in for my other half, Richard C. Hoagland, and he'll be back with you tomorrow morning for a great show, as always, and you can join me, those of you who don't sleep like most of us, at, let me see, 7 a.m. Pacific to 9 or 10 to noon Eastern for my show, Event Horizons. And love to have you join us. And it seems we're mixing a lot of people together. But now we have with us John Perkins, and we're just getting such an eye-opening story about what happens, how these manipulations take place, how these entrapments unfold. And it sort of underlines that old saying, if it's too good to be true, it is. Would you say that's how they all get caught up in that sticky paper, John?
That's a good way to put it, Robin. Yeah, unfortunately, it is true. And you know, the good news is that we can change that. As I said before the break, there were two reasons for me to write the book. I mean, you know, one is that things have gotten much worse, and the second is people are waking up. And actually, there's a third reason, and that is that the whole last section of the book, there's 40% new material in this, which tells about how we can turn it around, how each one of us can participate in changing this. You know, what I think it's fair to say we've created a failed global economy. And one statistic just really stands out, I think, above all others, and that is that less than 5% of the world's population lives in the United States, and we consume roughly 30% of the world's resources while half the world is starving or on the verge of starvation. Now, that's not a model. China can't repeat that. Brazil, India, Russia, nobody can repeat that. China's got 19% of the world's population. 5% consuming, 30% doesn't translate. The numbers don't add up. So it's a failed global economic model, and I call it a death economy that we've created. It's based on killing the earth, ravaging the very resources upon which the economy depends, destroying those resources. And also it's based to a large degree on war or the threat of war. We need to turn that around and create a life economy that's based on cleaning up pollution and helping starving people grow food more efficiently, feed themselves, and creating new technologies for transportation, communications, energy, banking, everything. Technologies that do not require tearing up the earth, that recycle, that draw upon sunshine and air and so on for energy. There's a vast array of things out there waiting to be done. We can create a beautiful new economic system. And it doesn't mean that we've all got to go back and live in grass houses or change our lifestyles very significantly. It simply means we have to come up with new concepts for what it means to be part of a vibrant economy, but a new economy, and not this death economy, not this old system, but a new system.
Yes, and wouldn't you say it's amazing how we get back to basics with the importance of community and sharing and taking care of our neighbors, things that were commonplace just 50 or 60 years ago, and suddenly they've been vilified, and people that are feeding the homeless, an organization like Food Not Bombs that has chapters around the world founded by Keith McHenry, these people get arrested because they set up and feed homeless people, people in need, people who have nowhere to go. They're living on the streets, and they just give them some sort of structure, and yet these people are put in jail.
Yeah. Well, Robin, you mentioned at the beginning of the show that I've written other books, five books on indigenous cultures and shamanism and so forth. And, you know, as I say in one of those books, I was a Peace Corps volunteer in the Amazon and Andes for 3 years before I was an economic hitman. And my life was saved by a shaman. I was dying at one point. And he required as payment for saving my life that I become his apprentice, which wasn't anything I had any desire to do back in 1968, 69, when I just graduated from business school. Who'd ever heard of a shaman? You know, there didn't seem to be any future there. That's changed now, I did. He saved my life, so I became his apprentice. And one of the things I learned, and it's really struck me since, is that shamanism sees the world as a dream. The title of one of my books, "The World Is As You Dream It," that when we have a concept and we give it energy, it materializes, and we come to understand that there are really two realities. So right now, there's the reality of the equipment that we're talking on, a microphone, a computer, whatever. That's an objective reality. You know, we're surrounded by objective realities. But there's another reality, which is the imagined reality. And as far as we know, human beings are the only living creatures that are deeply affected by this imagined reality. And the imagined reality is countries. You know, there really is no Russia, no China, no United States. We created borders. We've imagined borders. And then we've codified laws that actually put these borders into place so they become powerful parts of the objective reality. Religion is the same. Culture is the same. These are not objective realities. These are things that human beings have created through our imagination, and then codified into law or somehow made very present in our lives and have an important role. And one of those is this economy that we have that's based on looking at them as the problem, whether they're communists back in the 50s and 60s or terrorists, Muslims, immigrants, they are the problem. And debt is the way to get ourselves out of the problem by spending lots of money on things that will protect us from these problems, taxpayer money and other money. We've created a an imagined reality that the only way to grow an economy is through ravaging the earth, digging up, mining materials, minerals, and, you know, doing exactly what Iceland did. We talked about earlier with destroying huge amounts of land in order to create electricity to run aluminum plants. So what shamanism, what so much of us teaches, is that it's all we got to do now to change this is imagine a new reality. And that's where I come in with the life economy. And once we've imagined this new reality, we start to take actions that lend credence to this new reality, that actually make it happen. And it happens. And that can happen pretty quickly. Every revolution has been part of that aspect. The American Revolution, you know, there was the imagined reality that the British couldn't be defeated, the strongest empire in the history that couldn't be defeated. People like Tom Paine and Thomas Jefferson and Patrick Henry wrote and spoke out and said, yeah, they can be defeated. And George Washington, who'd fought with the British, said, yeah, they're vulnerable. And so suddenly a new reality emerged. Oh, maybe we can beat the British. And in the end, it happened. We see this over and over. We're at one of those times now. And that's, again, that's the third reason I wrote the book, is because I want to tell people how we change the old reality, the old imagined reality of a death economy, a failed global economy, and we turn it into a new reality that our children and grandchildren will thank us for.
And I thank you for empowering people with your work to let them know that it's up to them. They can take that power and be part of the healing, of the change that we need to get a world that we can be proud to pass on to future generations, where everything is not so ramped up on destruction all around on so many levels. And it is increasing, you know, day by day with contamination in so many areas, from pipelines, from nuclear reactors, from so many different things, and people just seem to tune out. And I know you have special projects, and I even got involved in taking one of the Pachamama courses to experience what you were working to do to reach out to people. And I found it very compelling and how moved the people in the courses were, because suddenly you found a way to give them that connection that you're talking about, back with the earth and back with each other. And I know that that's pretty widespread around the world with members. So that was a very interesting outcome from Confessions of an Economic Hitman.
Well, thank you. Yes, I'm a co-founder of this amazing nonprofit organization, the Pachamama Alliance. Another one, Dream Change, also. That's what I did when I quit being an economic hitman. I went back, and that's another whole story, but founded these nonprofits. And I'd encourage people to take a look. And you can go to johnperkins.org, which has links to all of those. Sign up for my newsletter. Take a look at those nonprofits. But yeah, it's all about changing the dream to one that creates an environmentally sustainable and regenerative, socially just human presence on this planet. And so thank you for mentioning that. And incidentally, I just wanted to clarify, during the break, I was looking up, the name of the book is Dreamland, a self-help manual for a frightened nation.
Ah, okay.
And it's on Amazon. The book is, it's by Andre Magnason. It's Andri Magnason. And I'm not sure where the film's available, but I think I don't see it on Amazon, actually, but I think it is available through YouTube or someplace. But maybe during the next break, I'll find that.
Okay, yeah, I can try taking a look for it as well, but definitely I will look for it. That's something I would like to see. And I know from how blown away I was when I heard about Iceland throwing out the bankers and later prosecuting them, to look deeper into their culture. And it's quite amazing. And they have a very rich connection with their other worlds, from what I understood.
Yes, they do.
They're special beings. And it's quite fascinating. Not something well known here. Well, I guess the United States seems to be one of the most insular countries.
Well, Iceland is a very advanced country. and highly educated, and as I said, has been one of the most economically advanced countries from a per capita standpoint. And at the same time, it still is a country that's very close to nature, volcanoes and geysers and glaciers and so on and so forth. And yes, they have a lot of wonderful stories and mythologies about basically trolls, elves, you know, and trolls who are turned into stone, and you'll find them throughout the landscape. You'll see these stones that look like amazing entities. Yeah, it's a fascinating country. I love Iceland. It's a fascinating country. And you know, it really came through this economic crisis by standing up to the European powers and the IMF. It's done a magnificent job that way, too.
Well, and I just hope, looking at what they've achieved and what you helped them achieve, that other countries will get the courage to say it's time for change and take apart the European Union. You know, because, of course, once one goes, it didn't go with Iceland, but once more of them, maybe, because it seemed if Greece would have gone, we would have had Spain, we would have had Ireland, we would have had everybody pull out. So what is that fear that keeps them entrapped, enslaved?
Would the fear, to say a little bit more.
The fear of pulling out from the European Union and having the courage to withstand the repercussions that will be small compared to the strict, problems that they have to live with to pay back, and the limitations. I think the suffering of the Greek people with it was tax after tax after tax, right, that was put upon the people for this part of the government and another part, and then social services disappeared. So how do the countries continue to live with it when they can just get out of it?
Well, it's scary to get out of it, you know, and it just like, it's very hard for people to stand up to authority. And I'll give you, I think, an example that maybe will explain that best. That's Ecuador, and it's a country that I'm very familiar with. Back in the 70s, when I was an economic hitman, Ecuador was run by dictators, military dictators, military junta, put into power and kept there by the CIA. And so they were our puppets. And I and other economic hitmen convinced these military dictators to take on huge loans to build up big infrastructure projects in the country, but primarily infrastructure projects that helped Texaco and other oil companies that have since ravaged large areas of the country, destroyed it, drilling for oil, just killed a lot of people. There's still huge messes in parts of the country. Many parts of Ecuador are absolutely beautiful. I take groups there every year to these beautiful areas out in the Amazon, but there's been a whole section that's destroyed. In any case, these dictators took on huge debts from the World Bank and the Inter-American Development Bank. When Rafael Correa, the current president, was elected and came into office a little less than eight years ago, he has a PhD in economics from the University of Illinois. He understands the system. And so one of the first things he did was, renegotiate the oil contracts to favor his country better, and to appoint a commission to look at these past loans. The commission concluded that about $3.5 billion of loans that Ecuador had taken on during the time of these military dictators in the 70s was illegal debt that the country didn't know it. That, as Correa said, and Correa, incidentally, read my book, Confessions of Economic Hitman, said, yeah, we were hit, endorsed my next book. And, you know, what he said is, he said, you know, my people don't owe all of this money. Maybe the World Bank owes it. Certainly the dictators that took it on owe it, but they've all left the country. They're now living in Switzerland or Miami or someplace. Maybe John Perkins and the other hitmen owe it, but my people don't owe it. So he refused to pay it. He you know, basically defaulted on this debt. Immediately, the IMF and other agencies dropped Ecuador's credit rating very, very low. China stepped in and gave Ecuador a loan of about $1 billion and made it easy for them to repay it, which then increased their credit rating.
Oh, my God, the game changer made it easy for them to repay it.
Yeah, and you know, and the sad thing here is now that a few years ago, roughly half of Ecuador's oil was going to the United States. This past year, none of Ecuador's oil went to the United States. It went to China. And the Ecuadorian government, as many Latin American governments today are saying, we would much rather have connections and trade agreements with China than with the United States. We'd rather take loans from China than the United States and its banks, because China's never killed any of our presidents or overthrown them in coups, never built military bases on our soil. The U.S. has done both of those things. And I say to them, well, don't you think China may do that ultimately? And they'll say, perhaps, but we don't know that. We do know that the United States has done that and will do that and will lie to us and will cheat us and will try to put us into debt servitude. China has not done that so far. And, you know, I think, Robin, that's very, very sad. And here's a president of a country who has a PhD in economics from a U.S. university. He loves the United States. He spent a lot of time here. He's married to a woman from Belgium. And yet he understands that the United States and our corporations have screwed his country. That's sad. We need to move beyond that. The United States is still a leader in the world. The world looks to us for leadership. And as I talk about it, the new confessions of an economic hitman, it's time for us really to assume that leadership position and to create a new model, a life economy that others will follow, including the Chinese, to set an example of how things can be done in a way that will create a world that our children and grandchildren will thank us for.
I agree with you, and I talk about bringing those changes and being those changes for everybody pretty much every morning on the air. And sometimes I can imagine my audience rolling their eyes, there she goes again. But it's so important. And when we, you know, you're making me think back with Greece when Russia was talking about having the gas pipelines go through Greece. And suddenly it seemed that's when everything ramped up and the screws were tightened on Greece.
Yeah.
With go ahead. I wanted your thoughts.
No, absolutely. That is what happened. Yes.
Yeah, and the vilification of Russia is so easy for Americans to fall into, and those that pay attention and look more carefully suddenly are seeing Putin as somebody who's trying to be a peacemaker and stand up for the individuals of a country to be able to have their own say. How do you view it?
How do I view Putin?
Yeah, yeah.
Well, I think, actually, I think Putin's in a very interesting and difficult position. In the last couple of months, I just came back from 5 weeks touring Latin America. But before that, I had two different TV film crews at my house here in the United States interviewing me. And, you know, one of the things that they pointed out is that the Russian people are very, very fearful of the United States.
With good reason.
Yeah. And, you know, they point out there was a Cold War that ended in 91, basically, when the Soviet Union dissolved. And the fact that the Soviet Union dissolved to them was a defeat. We won the Cold War. The United States won the Cold War. And their perspective is that after that, the United States was ruthless around the world. We were unopposed. There was no counterbalancing Soviet Union. And so our corporations and our CIA were ruthless. Any country that had oil or gas that we wanted, that oil and gas, we went after them. And we either convinced them through economic hitmen to give us their oil and gas, or we killed their leaders, or we sent in the military. And so the Russian people, I as I understand it, are fearful that that's really what's going on there now, and that's what the Ukraine is all about, that the United States has its sights on Russia. Now, I realize that many of your listeners are going to take deep exception to this, and I just want to say that's not my conclusion necessarily. I'm just repeating what I'm hearing from these Russian people.
Well, sure, but...
That they fear us. And Putin, you know, as president, as prime minister, premier, whatever, of a country that has a history of wanting strong leadership is in this position where he's got to stand up to us. And so when we overthrow a democratically elected president of Ukraine, mm-hmm. because that president sides with Russia, Putin needs to step in and at least, wave a sword or mount a tank without a shirt on or whatever it is he has to do. He's in a very, very awkward and difficult position.
Well, as you talked about the end of the Cold War and the fear that the Russians have, what did we do with dirty dealings? You know, the crashing of the ruble, the horrible after effects on the Russian economy. They have a lot of reason to be afraid, and it seems, you know, that this was being attempted again as suddenly Russia was getting stronger, and, you know, there seems to be a connection with the reorganization with Ukraine and Russia's pipeline spreading out through the rest of Europe. So I think their fears are well-founded.
Yeah.
But it's very, very compelling watching that and the spin, of course, and what's happening with Syria. Everybody that seems to be paying attention there, it's finally coming out when the United States had admitted making a mistake about which group they were supporting and supplying weapons to in Syria.
Mm-hmm. Yeah. Well, Syria is such a mess. And the only thing you can really say that makes any sense about Syria is that some very, very wealthy people in the United States, as well as in Russia and other places, are making a great deal of money off the war in Syria and throughout the Middle East. And I think that's something that we all need to understand. We often talk about how these wars are all about oil. Well, some of it's about oil, but a lot of it is just about the fact that war makes people rich, a few people a lot richer than they already were. You and I, Robin, may think that the United States lost the war in Vietnam, but there's a lot of wealthy people and corporate heads in the United States that won the war in Vietnam because they made fortunes off of it. The same thing is happening in Syria, Afghanistan, Yemen, Iraq, throughout so much of the Middle East.
Yeah, it's there's a quote of a friend of ours, the lie is different at every level. And as you think about that, you know, it really hits home with who's making the money. And you have the report from Iron Mountain that outlines pretty much in their summary and conclusions where we're at now and what can we do to get out of a world that the paradigm is based on war. You know, and that's, I know what you are trying to achieve with your efforts with Pachamama Alliance and the other groups. So there are a lot of questions coming in and a lot of people that want to ask you, about specifics. And we can get to those, you know, in the next hour.
All right. I look forward to that. And I just want to say that I have, in the meantime, my assistant here has found the movie Dreamland, which if you go to Andrei Magnason, AndreiMagnason.com, and then the subtitle is Plays and Films, Dreamland, you can get the film. It's a very interesting film. And AndreiMagnason.com.
Got it. I've got it written down, and I will share that with my audience as well tomorrow morning, this
thank
morning.
Thank you.
Great. Well, thank your assistant for us. It's like, which way to go? And also, I wanted to let the audience know, Em was sending a message that they can check at othersideofmidnight.com for the radio with pictures, and they have a rainforest trip there, which should be magnificent. I guess that's probably through Ecuador, but you were talking about the trips that you lead there.
Well, yeah, Robin, I do three trips a year. One
to
Ecuador, which is by invitation only. It's part of the Pachamama Alliance trips. But then I also do one which is open to the public, to Colombia in December, to the Kogi people up on the Caribbean coast. Beautiful, incredible. You know, we're on this coast where the mountains come right out of the Caribbean, the Sierra Nevada, and go up to 18,000 feet, snow-crested. And the rivers, the jungles, the Kogi people, these indigenous people are incredible. That's in December. And then every January, I do a trip to the Mayan people and their sacred sites in Guatemala. We work with shamans, elders, indigenous people. Go to johnperkins.org, trips, and you can find out all about it. And I'd love to have some of your readers sign up. Also, I'm just about to start tomorrow. In fact, I fly down to Portland, Oregon, and start a speaking tour at bookstores and other venues all across the United States. You can find out about that on johnperkins.org also.
Oh, that's wonderful. Thank you for sharing that. Well, this is a perfect time to go to break, and we can pick up where we've left off and expand upon more of these things and get some of the questions answered for the audience. So hang in there with us, guys. We'll be right back with more of The Other Side of Midnight and John Perkins. You're listening to The Other Side of Midnight, and if my voice sounds a little bit different, that's because this is Dr. Robin Falkov. Not Richard C. Hoagland, but he will be back tomorrow, and he will be feeling much better by then, and looks forward, of course, to talking with all of you. You guys know that it's wonderful for those of us that have these opportunities to connect with our audiences and know how much of a difference is being made, how important it is to share information about the work of you, John Perkins, and the insights you're giving us to these events around the world. And it's something to wake up for every day and to know that these are the steps and the foundations that we use to build upon, to have a secure way to bring about the things that need to be addressed so people can not think they're out there all alone, you know, they'll be a target. No, there are plenty of others standing right alongside of you. You're not going to take the hits by yourself. There are others with you, so that confidence can be restored and regained, and you can share it with others and reach out to others. It's all wonderful, and I thank you for giving out your websites for people to find out about your tours, John. That just sounds incredible to participate in them. And I know we were overwhelmed by Guatemala and the beauty of that country when Richard was part of a special with NBC Sci-Fi. And we went to Tikal, and it is just, it's magical. It's magical to see country like that and to be.
Yes. And you know, I've been working and living with and studying with and initiated by shamans, Mayan shamans, since the early 70s in Guatemala and the Yucatan area of Mexico. And so we go with these shamans, men and women, both, and their families sometimes, into the sacred sites and do fire ceremonies with them. It's spectacular. And in the middle of the night, we'll sometimes do these fire ceremonies and places where nobody's allowed. No tourists are allowed, but we're allowed in because we have this close connection and we're the local shaman. So that's pretty phenomenal, yeah.
It sounds incredible. You know, I'm sure everybody would love to be able to participate in those trips. And how long do they last?
Anywhere from a week to 2 weeks. Each trip is a little different. So just go on to johnperkins.org and it's all there.
Okay. Well, let me get to some of the questions that are coming in. And of course, you know, the important things that you want to make sure people get the idea of. I know a lot of attention has been drawn to the countries that want to get out of paying for oil with dollars. And we look at those other countries that are so rich in oil. And of course, we think of the unending chaos and undermining of governments that's taken place in South America. What do you see as unfolding now in countries like Argentina?
Well, you know, so I guess there's two questions here. One is countries that want to get out from using the U.S. dollar. Argentina's not one of those, I don't think, but we've seen certainly movements. Let's go back a bit. So back in the early 70s, there was an oil embargo. OPEC enforced an oil embargo against the United States, led by Saudi Arabia. I was an economic hitman at the time. The U.S. Treasury Department came to me and some other economic hitmen and said, hey, you know, we can't let this happen again. We're being blackmailed by OPEC. We can do something. Don't let this happen again. So we knew that something had to involve the House of Saud, the royal family of Saudi Arabia, that they led OPEC and they were corruptible and corrupt. So I went off to Saudi Arabia. And to make a long story short, we struck a deal with the House of Saud whereby they agreed to return most of their petrodollars to the United States by way of investing in U.S. Treasury securities. The interest from those securities would be used by the U.S. Treasury Department to hire U.S. corporations to essentially westernize Saudi Arabia, to build desalinization plants, petrochemical plants, in fact, whole cities out of the desert. And so that would benefit U.S. corporations to the tune of what's added up to trillions of dollars over the years. Also, Saudi Arabia agreed that OPEC would not buy or sell oil for anything other than dollars. This is 1973. In 1971, we'd gone off the gold standard. President Nixon had taken us off the gold standard. So the U.S. dollar had been out there floating kind of wildly around with nothing really supporting it. And now suddenly the U.S. dollar is on the petroleum standard. And it's been there ever since because of that agreement. We agreed to keep the House of Saud in power as long as they kept their agreements. And, of course, we've continued to do that. We've supported them ever since and continue to do it. And there's a lot of evidence that we may have, you know, rush family members out on private planes or your government planes after 9/11 and so forth. When other countries have stepped in and tried to take oil off the U.S. dollar, such as Saddam Hussein tried to do that, Gaddafi tried to do that in Libya, the Iranians tried to do that. In all of these cases, they were put down. In the case of the Iranian mullahs, they weren't actually put down, but the huge threats were made against them. And that's part of why the whole nuclear issue came up, because Iran was threatening to sell oil for something other than dollars. So we've been very, very protective of the dollar. Any country that's tried to sell dollars, has tried to sell oil for something other than dollars, has met huge resistance, including threats to its government or to its leaders, and in the case of Saddam Hussein and Gaddafi, assassination.
Well, doesn't it seem that these countries will have more support with the formation of the new bank with China and Russia and the other BRICS countries?
Absolutely. The BRICS Bank and the AIIB Bank, both of which are Chinese-led banks, are having a huge influence on the world today. And as a result of that, they're actually forcing the World Bank and its affiliates to soften their approaches. So we've seen this happening. These Chinese banks, AIIB and BRICS, Chinese-led, but they involve lots of other countries. AIIB involves a great many countries. BRICS is Brazil, Russia, India, China and South Africa. That's what BRICS stands for. But AIID includes most of the European countries and a great many countries around the world, led by the Chinese. And these banks are having a huge influence. They have more assets and many more potential assets than the World Bank or the IMF. And as a result, they're bringing competition once again into this world financial scene. So when the Soviet Union dissolved, suddenly there was essentially no competition. The U.S. and its banks, which includes the World Bank, which is really kind of a U.S. puppet, the IMF, mm-hmm. The Inter-American Development Bank, the Asian Development Bank, so many others, had the stage to themselves. And they did a lousy job. The opportunity was there to show the world that democracy works and our form of capitalism worked. And in fact, we did the opposite. Those banks became brutish. The institutions around them became exploitative. We really brought imperialism into the world, economic imperialism. So now this new power has emerged, China. It's created these new banking systems that are in direct competition with the World Bank and its affiliates, and it's causing the World Bank and its affiliates to have to step back and take and re-examine their position and soften their positions. It's a very interesting situation.
And you know what has me very curious? I look at the proximity of Argentina, Venezuela, the South American, Central American countries, but those two, which are so rich in oil, Argentina and Venezuela, and being so close to the United States, if suddenly they changed and suddenly they had stronger affiliations with the new bank that has formed, you know, that would be looked upon as, I guess, a direct threat. What do you think? What do you think the chances are that they could separate and change their economies from dollars?
Well, that's always a possibility, and Venezuela threatened to do that under Chavez. And one of the reasons that we went after Chavez, he was, you know, there was a coup launched against him in 2000 under the Bush administration. He survived that coup, and that changed the history of Latin America. The fact that Chavez was very smart. You can think what you want about Chavez, and I'm not promoting Chavez. I have a lot of problems with the Chavez administration. Venezuela today is in turmoil. It's a wrecked economy. Chavez has to take a great deal of the responsibility for that. But one thing that he did do is he changed the history of Latin America. When he survived the 2002 CIA coup, and after surviving it, the Bush administration did not pursue it, did not go in with the military, probably to a large degree because they're already overextended in the Middle East, and also the oil companies didn't want to upset the apple cart. They were afraid that oil was not going to be accessible in the Middle East, and Venezuela might be their only hope. Whatever the reason, there was no attempt after this attempted coup that failed to follow up with a military invasion, which is the old practice. And because that happened that way, the United States looked like a paper tiger in Latin America. 10 countries after that, 10 countries that through most of my lifetime had military dictatorships, brutal ones, for the most part put into power by the CIA and kept there. These 10 countries got rid of those dictatorships and had democratic elections and put into power pretty progressive leaders. You mentioned Argentina. That's certainly one of them. Ecuador, Chile, Nicaragua, 10 countries in total. And that was significant. And that happened because Chavez stood up to the CIA and to the United States. So it's been a very, very significant time. And I think it's fair to say today that perhaps Latin America is really the leader in democracy today. I wish the United States had taken that role, but we haven't, and Latin America really has. And incidentally, go ahead.
I was going to say it's fascinating your assessment. I'm just pleased. Go ahead, continue.
Many countries in Latin America are true democracies. Also, from the standpoint that everybody votes, Ecuador, again, is a good example. I'm very familiar with Ecuador. I spent time there as an economic hitman. But before that, I was a Peace Corps volunteer there. I lead groups there. I go back every year. And it, like a number of other Latin American countries, doesn't require, but its citizens, for the most part, carry something called a cédula, which is roughly the equivalent of a driver's license or a passport, maybe, an internal passport. It's like a driver's license. It has your picture. It's this little card you carry. And in order to have that card, you have to vote.
Oh, my gosh.
And if you don't have that card, it's pretty difficult to get a driver's license or a bank account to do almost anything, because that's your ID. And nobody tells you that you have to vote. But if you don't vote, you don't get this government card, which is a very important item to have. So most everybody votes. And I think that's actually a wonderful thing. It's not that you're forced to vote, but it's said that if you're not willing to vote, then you're not willing to be part of the system. And therefore, you don't get one of these cards that helps you enter the system. So something like 99.5% of the population votes.
Wow.
Unlike the United States, where I don't remember what the numbers are, but they're pretty low, 30%. I don't know. It's well below 50%. And so you really have a democratic process.
Well, that would be great if we could implement that here, and even with elections, because we know how much the changing of votes can take place. If everybody has their cards and everybody, well, I don't see a problem with saying who I would vote for. If people could then share, and if there was some way of doing that online, you know, for who they voted for, because we've seen too many elections suddenly, polling after people came out from voting showed that it was all going one way. And then you find out, no, there was a landslide the other direction. So that would kind of nip those things in the bud.
Right. But yeah, truly. So, and yeah, I was just looking, I just popped up on my screen here that a question came in from a listener about, are we in the U.S. being hit by economic hitmen? Absolutely. You know, and again, that's one of the reasons I wrote the book, because since the first book, The Confessions of an Economic Hitman, came out in 2004, things have gotten so much worse, Robin. We've been badly hit here. Huge amounts of debt. We know about, you know, student loan debt, mortgage debts, which have gone up, debts around health care, because there's no affordable health care system in this country, credit card debt. That's for the average person. Huge debts that are being taken on by our country itself, going into debt to China, Japan, and other places. And I think it's important to understand that when I was an economic hitman, we were a fairly small group of people. We were really generic. I would go off to countries and get them to hire U.S. corporations to build big infrastructure projects, as I described earlier. But I didn't really care which companies they hired. They could hire Brown & Root or Halliburton or Bechtel or Stone & Webster, as long as it was a U.S. corporation. We've still got those kind of people today. In addition, every major corporation, all the ones I just mentioned, plus Kmart and Walmart and Exxon and Texaco, Chevron and Nike and Reebok, all those companies have their own version of economic hitmen who are out promoting just those companies. And many of them have their versions of jackals who are willing to foment violence if the economic hitmen aren't listened to. And in the United States now, we have this vast army of people leveraging their power with the U.S. government extensively. So, you know, through a great deal of my lifetime, I think our elected officials in the United States did what the people who elected them wanted them to do for the most part. That's not true anymore.
Mm.
We elect people to Congress, to the Senate, and once they're in, they listen to the corporations that are giving them the money for the next campaign. And also these same corporations are saying, hey, you know, if you lose or you decide not to run in the future, you'll have a very, very lucrative consulting contract with us. And so many of these people, in essence, are economic hitmen. They go into Congress, they go into the House of Representatives or the Senate, and they represent big corporate interests. And when they get out of their elected jobs, they continue to represent those corporate interests. They're essentially lobbyists. Many of them are not registered as lobbyists. That we've got about 13,000 registered lobbyists in the United States, but roughly another 100,000 people who call themselves corporate consultants, government advisors, and so on and so forth. They are acting as lobbyists, so they're not registered. These are truly economic hitmen. At the same time, the jackals have spread in this country hugely. You know, we've seen this with drones and with listening to our telephones and our emails. Right now, this classic battle that's going on between Apple and the FBI is a case in point, where the FBI is determined to exercise its policing powers in a very unethical and, in my opinion, illegal way.
I agree with you.
And to stand up to them and being supported by a lot of people, but I tell you, it's a tough battle for a company like Apple. It's probably great for their public relations, but it's not an easy battle for them to fight.
And wouldn't you think that there isn't much that the powers that be don't have a backdoor access to, but putting this out there in public is to make it legal so that they can then use it openly with what they find or claim that they're finding?
Yeah, totally. I totally agree, yes.
It's very disconcerting, that, and that's one of the most popular conversations that has been going on Facebook and Twitter and so many areas, because people are so appreciative that there's a company that wants to stand up and, you know, protect the rights of their people, or at least maintain the illusion that we still have some.
Well, I think, I don't know what motivates Apple Apple's one of these big, huge companies that has, in my opinion, way too much power. And yet here they are up against the FBI, which also has a tremendous amount of power. And I really don't know what the motivating force is. But what I do know is that I totally support the idea that we need less vigilance, that the FBI has no right to go in and look at these files. And we really need to fight that. You know, the police state has just gotten way, way too strong.
Yeah, thank you. It's such an important point, and more people are concerned with the ramifications that go along with the new changes being made to the trade treaties. And it took so long before that information would even be released for anybody to see it. What do you think the chances are of that being derailed? I know they have enormous patience to wait to be able to initiate that again if, let's say, it doesn't go through now. How do you view these trade treaties?
Oh,
TPP, hell, you know.
The trade treaties are terrible. You know, in theory and in practice, I believe in free trade, but that's not what these trade treaties give us. That's not free at all. And TTIP and TPP are both methods for giving corporations an awful lot more power, sovereignty, in fact, over nations.
Mm-hmm.
You know, and we can look at what happened with CAFTA, the Central American Trade Agreement, and NAFTA, the mm-hmm. North American Trade Agreement, which includes Mexico and Canada, as well as the United States. These agreements destroy the economies of Central America. They are the reason that we have what we're calling an immigration problem. And the way that worked is that under those agreements, countries are not allowed to impose tariffs, but countries are allowed still to subsidize businesses in their country. So here's the example. Let's say that a Central American farmer can produce corn at $3 a unit. It costs in the United States a big agri company $5 a unit to produce that same amount of corn. But the United States government gives the agribusiness a $3 subsidy. So in fact, this U.S. agricultural company can sell their corn in Central America for $2.50 for the unit and still make 50 cents, while the local peasant has to sell his for more than $3 a unit. It's driven these people out of business all over Central America.
Tragic.
Small farmer, corn, cotton, many other products. And they've left their land. They swarm into the United States to try to get jobs farming here or mowing our lawns or, you know, picking fruit, whatever they possibly can. They live miserable lives here. They don't want to be here. They live sometimes 15. I speak Spanish. I hang out with these people sometimes. 15 men living in a single, you know, bedroom apartment, sharing it, saving all that, working 24/7 basically, sending their money back home. They do not live great lives here. They don't want to be here. We've destroyed their economies, and because they've left their land, now the big agribusinesses go in. I was just in Mexico 2 weeks ago. The agribusinesses go into this land that's been deserted. They're growing broccoli, which most Mexicans don't eat. It's not a favorite food there, for export to the United States, and other products grown in these massive, huge fields where you used to have little individual farmers, peasants who were able to eke out a living off the land and make a decent living for their families. No longer can do it. So our immigration problem, as we call it, let's build a fence across the border to stop this, right? No, the way to stop it is to go back and allow their economies to grow, help them to grow, or just allow them to grow, cut down these trade barrier, these free trade agreements. So what's happened, you know, so these countries are not allowed to put a tariff on that would make the price equalized, and yet we in the United States are allowed to have a subsidy. Guatemala, Honduras, El Salvador, Mexico, they can't afford to subsidize their small farmers. We do subsidize our huge agribusiness farmers because they give so much money back to politicians.
And not our small farmers. Our small farmers here suffer as well.
Exactly, yes.
So it's you know, around the world, these are the people being squeezed. And this is something, you know, when the question was asked about, is the United States being hit? Part of what happens with this corporatocracy strengthening, there are less and less jobs here in the States. You know, everything gets exported, and whatever it is causes horrific conditions in the other countries, as you were detailing. So, yes, how do we cut back on that? How do we turn that tide?
Well, we don't go through with these trade agreements. And honestly, the Democrats have to a large degree opposed these trade agreements. I don't understand why Obama's supporting it. Frankly, he's going against his own party. Although more Democrats are coming around. Big business is very powerful, and it's very seductive. The businesses that want these free trade agreements are offering our politicians huge incentives to side with them, not only in campaign financing, but as I mentioned before, jobs when they get out of their you know, when they stop holding their official positions, they can go to work as consultants, etc.
Yeah, it's just such a self-propagating.
Yeah, and Robin, I wanted to go back for just a moment and address this Apple FBI thing. This morning, I heard on NPR radio an interviewer with the head of the FBI who was commenting on. Apparently, he's using as precedent for saying that, you know, the FBI has a right to this information getting into the emails and other communications that are done through Apple. The precedent is that you can get a search warrant to break into somebody's safety deposit box, you know, strong box in the bank, and it's the same situation. And I find that fascinating that he would say something like that. I take strong exception to it. There's a huge difference, you know. If you get a key, if you can get a warrant to have the bank turn over a key to a safe deposit box, you're probably going to find in that safe deposit box, you know, some stashed away money, maybe a few correspondences. But when you force a company like Apple to open its door to email and all the other kinds of communications that go through the Apple system, you're not only going into the person's account that you're looking for, and in this case, we're talking about someone who's suspected of terrorism, but you've opened the door to get into huge amounts of other people's information that you don't have a warrant about. And that's a very different situation from getting into somebody's safe deposit box.
Yes. I thank you for making that point. Let's pick that up on the other side. We're going to go to break, and then we're in the last segment of the show, John. The time has just flown by. Hang in there, guys. We'll be right back with more of The Other Side of Midnight and John Perkins. Okay, my friends, we are back. I'm Dr. Robin Falca, filling in for Richard C. Hoagland. This is The Other Side of Midnight. Find us at darkmatterdigitalnetwork.com. Look for The Other Side of Midnight.com as well. There's a lot of discussion going on there, on Twitter, all over. Lots of questions from the audience and lots of concerns. And this is just so much information, John. You have made such an enormous contribution with your work for people to finally get the insights that will give them a backbone. I look at it and the people are so afraid to be the first one. And you took that step forward and put yourself in the line of fire, and they can all learn from your many books, the audiobooks for those who have lots of time spent driving back and forth to work. Use it. You know, get the audiobooks, listen to this important information, and start talking. I always look at long lines in a bank, in a post office, as a perfect opportunity to talk to people in my neighborhood, in my communities, and get to know what they think. So,
well, that's so important, Robin. And in the New Confessions of an Economic Hitman, I spell out a real strategy for changing all of this, for turning the death economy into a life economy. One of the most important things is for us all to keep spreading the new story that we can change, that we have the power to change. Whether you're standing in line someplace or writing blogs or emails or Facebook posts or Twitters, keep doing this. You know, I speak at a lot of events around the world, including ones to CEOs of big corporations. And it's funny because I recently spoke to 4,000 CEOs of major corporations. When I was invited to give that keynote lecture, I called the organizers and said, why on earth would you want me to speak at your conference? Is there some mistake here? And they said, no, there's no mistake. You know, these CEOs are smart people. They realize that the system's failing. It's a failure. And they don't know how to change it. They want to know how to change it. And, you know, as I've spoken at this conference and then hung out with a number of these CEOs for several days afterwards and talked to them, what I kept hearing was, we need our customers to tell us to do a better job. Many of them would say to me, you know, I want my company to be greener. I want it to be a better citizen. I want it to do a better job. But I'm afraid that if I make that happen, I may lose half a percentage point of market share. And if I do, the key stockholders, the really powerful people, will get me fired. And I'll be replaced by someone who only cares about market share. So please tell everybody you speak to send me an email. And to tell all their friends to send me an email once a week, Facebook posts and so forth, saying, hey, I love your product. I want to help you. I want to buy your products, but I won't buy them anymore until you pay your workers in Indonesia a living wage, or until you drill for oil without destroying the earth, or until you clean up pollution. You know, if every one of your listeners, Robin, just selects any corporation, the one of their choice, be it Monsanto or Exxon or Walmart or Kmart or whatever it is, and launch a consumer campaign, social networking media makes it so easy to do this these days, and it has a huge impact. You know, it doesn't take a lot of people. When I was in college in Boston, we couldn't walk beside the Charles River. It was so polluted. And rivers in the Middle West were on fire with pollution. We got corporations to clean them up. There was apartheid in South Africa. We boycotted corporations that supported it. Just a few of us. It doesn't take very many. And they pretty much got rid of apartheid. We forced corporations to open their doors wider to women and to minorities. We, the people, have the power. Our elected officials don't. They're in very difficult positions. Our president doesn't. We focused for 2 years on this crazy race for the presidency. It's a distraction because what the president has some powers. We used to think one of the powers the president had was to appoint Supreme Court justices, but we're getting to question that now. Will Obama be able to do it? We don't know. It looks as though he may not be able to. The fact of the matter is our elected officials really don't have that much power. They're very, very vulnerable to scandals, to being exposed for or have lies created about them that will destroy their careers. We have to accept the fact that we must do it. We have the power. The corporations control our government and most of the world government, and yet they are vulnerable to us. They are only successful because we buy their goods and services, or we allow our tax dollars to buy their goods and services, or we invest in them, or allow our pension funds, etc., to invest in them. We need to turn this around. It's up to us to do it.
I thank you because you laid that out and it is so empowering. I try to remind audiences that every time they are going to make a purchase for a service, a product, whatever it is, they're either accepting or rejecting. And if these businesses or services are not answering their questions, changing to meet the needs of the people that they expect to buy their products, and they get told, don't worry, you know, you don't need to know that. We don't need to have that on the label. Well, the simple thing is, why would you keep buying from them?
Exactly. Yes. And, you know, it's not enough to just not buy the product, but we've got to let them know.
Mm-hmm.
So, you know, if you don't like what Nike, for example, is doing with its workers in Indonesia or wherever, You don't buy a Nike product, but you also write an email and you get all your friends to write emails and you say, hey, Nike, I love your product. I love you, but I'm not buying them anymore until you pay your workers in Indonesia a fair living wage. And you know, I don't mean to single Nike out. There's so many companies like that, and Nike is doing some very good things. They all are, and we encourage them to do it. I love the fact that you've switched from oil-based glues to water-based glues, and you must pay your workers a fair price. You know, we need to understand that these companies, the corporations control the world today, and they're not bad organizations. They're just organizations. I talked earlier about imagined reality. A corporation is only an imagined reality. There's nothing objective out there. They may produce objective products. A car is an objective product. A tennis shoe is an objective product. But the company behind that and its philosophy is an imagined reality. When I went to business school, I was taught, this is back in the late 60s, I was taught that a good CEO makes a decent rate of return for his investors. But beyond that, he takes good care of his employees. He doesn't lay anyone off without first taking a cut in salary himself. Imagine that.
Yes.
Yeah. And he takes good care of his customers and his suppliers. And he's a good citizen in the communities where his company works. He pays taxes. Imagine that. I don't pay taxes these days. But beyond paying taxes, I was taught a good CEO also donates money to local school systems, recreational facilities. He's a good citizen. That all changed in the 70s when I was an economic hitman, and Milton Friedman won the Nobel Prize in Economics for saying the only responsibility of business is to maximize profits.
Mm.
And that became the goal of corporations. That is now what corporations say. We just maximize profits. And, you know, that's a license to kill. It's a license to bribe governments in order to create laws that mean that you're not really bribing. When you're bribing, it's no longer defined as a bribe because it's become legitimatized through new laws.
Sure, and it allows people to live with a form of soft slavery because they can work three jobs and they're not going to get ahead because what used to be, what you just described, that was so beautiful with those corporations giving back to the communities where people weren't looking for the government to step in. It was the businesses, your local people that helped each other out. You know, that's being considered against the law at this point in time, which is insanity.
Yeah. Yeah. But we need to turn that around.
Yeah.
And we can turn that around. You know, we need to tell these corporations, look, your job is not to maximize profits. Yes, make a decent rate of return for your investors. We need investors because we need to move from a death economy to a life economy. And that means developing new technologies for energy, for transportation, for communications, for so much that's out there. No more ravaging the earth. We don't need to mine or drill for any more oil. You know, there's a lot of plastic around. That's oil. You know, the seas are filled with islands of plastic.
Oh, yes.
Mine them. And the earth has a tremendous amount of seepage, oil seepage. Every gas station, or every old gas station has seepage. And throughout the Amazon, throughout so many parts of the world, there's oil that we can extract. That's leaked in the process of drilling. We need to develop technologies that will allow us to take advantage of these things that have already been done, not mine for more. This is a tremendous opportunity here to create a vast new economy. We just
yes.
have the imagination and the willpower to do it.
Most definitely. There's a young man I think he's in his 20s now, that won an award for his idea for how to clean the oceans of the plastic and recycle it. And that's finally going to be implemented. And I didn't, you know, we were just talking about it now. I didn't have time to look him up. But it was a very powerful story that somebody with vision got recognized and they're actually going to do something about it. I mean, because just what you're describing, there are literal islands of plastic, and you think of what can be done with reclaiming that. I wanted to make a point or to ask you to make a point that you have in your books, which I found to be something that a lot of people will be able to wrap their minds around, where you suggest if they become a shareholder, that gives them a legal right to share their views at the meetings for these corporations.
Well, that's true. And, you know, I certainly encourage that for people to, you know, if you buy stock in a company, even a small amount, you can go to the shareholders meeting and speak out. And that can be effective. I think even more effective is to put together a consumer campaign because, you know, you can stand up in a stockholders meeting and say something and get shot down or whatever happens. But if you launch a consumer campaign and if a company receives 100,000 emails saying, change your policies or I'm not going to buy from you, 100,000 people say that has a huge, huge impact. So I would say both things are important. You know, yeah, buy a share stock, go to the shareholders campaign. That's a big effort. You got to buy the stock. You got to get on an airplane, fly to this.
But good points. Yes. Sorry.
And I'm totally in favor of it. You know, do it. But I'd also say that an easier way, a cheaper way, is to get on your social media and launch a consumer campaign. This is extremely effective. It's so big and it's so important and it can be so effective. I have to say, Robin, that I know a lot of executives in corporations I don't know any ones that are bad people. I'm not saying that they're not out there. There are sociopaths out there. Certainly we saw them at Enron. We've seen them at other corporations. But the majority of the corporate executives are good people, have kids, grandchildren, want to do the right thing. They just need us to push them to do the right thing. And incidentally, even the sociopaths, if we show them that the only way they're going to be successful is if they buy into this life economy, if they serve a public interest, they'll do it. And that needs to be the new mantra. Don't, you know, make a decent rate of return for your investors and serve a public interest. Don't just serve a few wealthy investors. Make a decent rate of return, but not windfall profits for a handful of wealthy investors. Serve a public interest. And incidentally, we have a great precedent in the United States. For the first 100 years we were a country, no corporation could get a charter in any state until it demonstrated that it was going to serve a public interest. Charters lasted on average for 10 years, and then the company had to go back and demonstrate that it had served a public interest and would continue to do so. That all changed in the late 1800s when John D. Rockefeller went to Delaware and convinced the politicians in Delaware that they needed to make an exception for his companies, Standard Oil companies, and they didn't need to follow this principle, and that if they made that exception, he would pay high taxes and all the politicians in Delaware would become wealthy. And then he did the same thing in New Jersey. And now this has spread. Yeah. So now you don't need to prove this. You can get a corporate license for just paying $75, basically. We need to turn that around, and we need to say that corporations have a responsibility to we the people, to serve a public interest, make a decent rate of return for investors. We need to invest in new technologies and serve a public interest and make sure those technologies are headed towards serving a public interest.
Most definitely. And would you say the key to that is more empowerment for the states to enforce these things?
Well, the states won't get the empowerment unless the corporations want them to. So the key is we the people.
Yeah.
And incidentally, in the new Confessions of an Economic Hitman, I outline a complete strategy for doing this. It includes a list for various people, retired people, students, people between retired and student, corporate executives, entrepreneurs, lists for various types of people as to what we each can do to make this happen. And so what I want to say is that every one of your listeners has an amazing role to play in this. This is an exciting time. There's nothing more fun or blessed to do than to create a better world for ourselves and for future generations. And we each have that opportunity and that responsibility. And it can be fun. It needs to be fun. We need to make fun of this. I'm having a lot of fun doing this, and everybody can have fun doing it. Just, you know, do it in your own way. If you're a dentist, when you get your hands in your mouth, talk about this. If you're a carpenter, and incidentally, just today I was sitting in a restaurant with my grandson and my daughter, and this man and his family came up to me, and he said, "Hey, are you John Perkins?" And I said, "Yeah." He said, I watched you on YouTube. I'm a carpenter, I'm a contractor, and I love to hear you." And he said, "You know, you've encouraged me to only build with sustainable products and to constantly tell the people that I'm working for that that's what I'm doing." That's so important, Robin. And if you're a parent, you teach your children, doesn't matter what you do, every one of us has a role to play in this. And it's so exciting, and it can be a lot of fun.
I agree, and it's wonderful that you have so many ways to empower everybody, because we see retired people that think that, well, there's nothing they can contribute, and they have time. That's a wonderful thing that affords them the ability to get those petitions and send those emails and do all these activities that you're discussing. So,
well, and beyond time, they
experience.
Well, and if they're retired, they can't be fired.
Ah, yes.
So they got nothing to lose. I don't have to say this to people. I speak at some retirement events, and I say to people, "Hey, you know, if you're retired, you can't be fired. Get out there and rattle the cage." Yes, call upon your experience and rattle the cage because there's no bad repercussions.
Well, wonderful information. Is the book available now? Your new version of Confessions of an Economic Hitman. Are people able to buy that? Oh, we lost you. Okay, let me see if I could get John back. Okay. Hang in there, guys. I urge you all to get his book. Here he is. Okay, he's coming back on again.
Yeah, I thought I was hitting the mute button because I wanted to get a drink of water and not have you have to hear the water running, and instead I hit the... Anyway, here I am.
You're back. So that's all good. And I'm just urging the audience to be able to get their lives changed, and then they have the ability to go out and share it with others when they read your book. And there are so many things that will empower others. And I find that to be such a big deal, because people are always, I don't have money. I have to work two jobs. There's nothing I could do. But hey, here's a toll-free number. You can make a call. You can send an email. You can sign a petition. And it's just, maybe not everybody can buy your book. Maybe they can have discussions. Gee, remember old book clubs?
Yeah, listen, you know, we've all got a role to play in this every single day. I talk in the new Confessions of an Economic Hitman about a lot of things, but one of the stories I tell is about a time I was leading a group of about 30 people into northern India, and the Dalai Lama, who'd been reading my book Shapeshifting, it's a long story, but the details are in the new Confessions, invited us to his house in Dharamsala, India. So there's 33 of us sitting in his living room.
Okay, we've got about 3 minutes.
talking to him, and someone asked him what he thinks about if everybody gets together on a certain day and everybody around the world prayed for peace. He said, well, praying for peace is good, but if that's all you do, it's a waste of time and maybe a distraction. If you walk away saying, I've done my job, I prayed for peace, that's all I need to do, that's a distraction and a failure. You got to act, he said, every single day. And so I want to encourage all your listeners, Robin, to understand that we each have to act every day. And it can be a small act like sending an email or posting something on Facebook, encouraging people to send emails to a corporation to get them to change. Or it can be as big as going out on the streets and demonstrating and going to jail. There's all kinds of things that we can do. We each must follow our passion, but to recognize that daily action to make a life economy, to change the world, to create a world that future generations will thank us for, is so much fun and so important. Let's all get on the bandwagon and make it happen.
And that is wonderful, because the richness that it brings to people's lives when they see the response from others, when they let them know, yeah, there's something you can do. We can take these actions. It's not going to cost us anything. And then they get great results in their communities. And those are great ways to build. And you are just so inspiring. Your information is on the site for ordering your book. We've just got a couple of minutes left. So I'd love for you to What are your closing words for the audience? You've said so much and you've shared so much. What do you want to leave them with on top of all of that?
Well, Robin, just that I think we're living in the most amazing time in human history. There have been a lot of amazing times, but we're in the midst of a consciousness revolution, perhaps the biggest revolution ever, bigger than the agricultural or industrial revolution, an awakening, a realization that we're living on a very fragile space station, the Earth. And there are no shuttles. We can't get off. And we're in the process of destroying it as we know it for human life. We need to turn that around. And this is an exciting, wonderful time to be waking up this way. I am so excited. I feel so blessed to be on shows like yours, to be participating with you, to be able to travel around the country, around the world, talking about these things. But I think all of us should be excited about whatever it is we can do to participate in this revolution. It's a great revolution. It's an amazing experience. And again, I'd also like to, you know, strongly urge your listeners to go to my website, johnperkins.org, go to my Facebook page, Twitter. I'm on all of those. Go to my website, johnperkins.org. Sign up for the newsletter that comes out once a month, a couple of blogs a month. And also, I'm just about to launch this tour around the United States of speaking. I hope many of your listeners will come and hear me in Portland, Oregon, Miami, Washington, D.C., New York, San Francisco, all the various places where I'll be. It's all listed on my website.
We will be happy to share that. I'll share that on my show. Obviously, I'll be talking about you and looking forward to having you on Event Horizons as well. It has been a pleasure and an honor for all the work that you are doing to make this world a better place and to give hope back. That is the most amazing gift, to be able to restore hope. And you do that, John, and I thank you for that. And I thank all the listeners for being part of this great big family, for Other Side of Midnight, for your involvement and your participation as a group to work to make things better. And when we all share, we can achieve our goals. So it's been just an outstanding experience with you. And I know from all the feedback and all the messaging that we're getting, the audience just wants more. And I know you've got to hear that all the time. So can we clone you?
Absolutely. Everybody out there can be part of this revolution. Thank you so much, Robin.
My pleasure. My pleasure. I'll look forward to speaking with you the next time. And thank you all for being with us here at the Other Side of Midnight. We'll be back tomorrow morning at midnight. See you guys then.
Good night.
Good night, all.